It's a question that plagues many, if not all, parents. How do I raise a happy child? Our guest today has put in a lot of thought into finding the answers to what children need in order to grow up healthy and happy. Professor Lucy Kluver is a professor of child and family social work at the University of Oxford, and her work focuses on providing evidence that can improve the lives of children and adolescents in sub-Saharan Africa. Professor Kluver started out as a child protection social worker during South Africa's AIDS epidemic. That experience influenced her to change careers and continues to influence her work. From 2010 to 2012, she ran the Young Carers Study, which looked at the impact of being a young carer on children's well-being in AIDS-affected families. Over 6,000 children and 2,500 caregivers were interviewed in the South African provinces, making it the world's largest study on children in AIDS-affected families. So, in 2015, she was awarded the University of Oxford's youngest ever female full professorship. In March 2020, when 1.9 billion children were in lockdown with their parents, she co-led the COVID-19 Emergency Parenting Response to develop evidence-based, open-source resources. She worked with colleagues at international organisations with the knowledge that the numbers of child abuse victims rose when they were cooped up with adults for long periods of time. These resources were translated into an astounding 100 languages and disseminated to over 200 million people. Professor Lucy Kluver, thanks for joining us on the We Society podcast.
Gosh, well, first of all, please call me Lucy, and then I can call you Will if that's okay.
Happy to call you Lucy.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny when you said a change of career from social work to social science, and I don't see it really as a change of career at all. It's just that I'm doing, and I'm lucky I get to do social work on a larger scale and with a better evidence base than I was able to do, you know, when I was walking through the dusty streets of townships in South Africa. And I think that's where it started. You know, I was working as a social worker. I was 21 and I had an office that had a big sign on the door of it with a gun and a line through it. And it said, "This is a gun-free zone." And I was doing hard-end child protection social work at a time when we had no antiretroviral medicine in South Africa. So the death rates of HIV were universal. You know, everyone who caught HIV was dying. And it really just changed the way that I saw the world. And when I asked the social work agencies that I was working with what they needed, you know, thinking that they needed more social workers or more financial support, what they said was, "We need more evidence. We have this huge challenge, these millions of children who are losing their parents, and we need to know what to do to support them." I mean, that's why I became a social scientist.
And you've done some extraordinary work. I mean, the testimony to some of the kind of ways in which communities have used your work, you know, pastors in Malawi, Buddhist monks in Tibet. I mean, it's really a testimony to your reach. And just to kind of as a tease before we get into the body of the podcast, is there two or three real things that you would foreground that you, when people finish it, you want them to have a takeaway? I mean, I began my intro by saying, how do I raise a happy child? What's the answer to that question?
I think I would say three things. The first is that over the last 10 years, I've been astounded by how universal the challenges of parenting are. When we set up rapidly the COVID-19 emergency parenting response, we had hundreds of volunteers and we divided them up by region and by which languages they spoke. And, you know, we had religious people calling religious agencies and organizations and different teams. And one of the things that I did was call government ministers and offer them support with parenting for their countries. And what astounded me was the responses that we got. You would call up a government, very, very senior government ministers, and start explaining that, you know, you'd see higher rates of child abuse in lockdown situations and that this was a potential national risk. And they would say, "Please tell me what to do. I'm stuck in my house with my four kids. I'm going crazy. Just send me the tips." And you realize that this was something that was not them. It was us. And when you realise that, then you start seeing it all quite differently, actually. The second thing that I think we've really learned from the evidence is that you just need enough money to get by. There's so much compelling evidence now that just having a basic standard of social protection, of some kind of financial support for a family, is fundamental in everything from mental health to education to prevention of violence, prevention of child exploitation. It's a fundamental need that we should be providing to every family. And the last thing that we've really learned over the past 5 years is that that financial support is massively maximized and is not sufficient on its own without some parenting support. And that support from a parent or any caregiver, it doesn't need to be a biological parent, is not complicated. It's spending 5 minutes a day with a child, giving them your attention. It's praising them, telling them they've done well when they've done something well. It's spending a moment to problem solve when something's going wrong or you think it's going to go wrong. And that combination of cash plus care, we often call it now, the evidence shows can change a child's life in the most fundamental and long-lasting ways.
Let's start off in South Africa, because some of what you're saying, I'm thinking, must also apply, you know, to us in the UK. I mean, it's more than 10 million, I think it's just under 10 million families have acute cash needs and, you know, are on the subsistence level. And there's, you know, some millions of children which are going to go hungry every day. So it's not only the less developed world in which these things take place. But let's start with South Africa and AIDS and why it was that kids were getting AIDS and dying from AIDS. I mean, some really disturbing things come out of that.
The enormity of the HIV epidemic and the massive impacts that it had on children made us have to think very differently about how and what we do. And that's very vague, but we suddenly had this disease that within the space of just a few years swept across Africa. And the people it killed were the people of childbearing age. And it killed women more than men. And so what you had was this generation of children losing their parents to a disease which was, particularly before antiretrovirals, truly awful. And what we suddenly needed to understand was, what were the most effective services that they needed? What did we need not to do, like sending them to orphanages? And I think really importantly, what could we do at scale? We weren't thinking about a few hundred children. We were thinking about millions of children. And I think that's something to me which is really fundamental in how we do social science and intervention science. We have to move from thinking in hundreds to thinking in millions. And when COVID hit, that became from thinking in millions to thinking in hundreds of millions. And so when I was in my 20s and working in the depths of the HIV epidemic, it felt like that was the most enormous crisis that I could ever imagine. And now, 15 years later, we open every newspaper and what we see is these accumulating crises, you know, wars and climate crises and, you know, the risk of a new pandemic. And I think, again, you know, we need to make these kinds of shifts. I think we need to try and do it now, though, not to do what we did in HIV, which was, I think we started too late with the evidence for children.
You talked about, you know, cash plus care as being the kind of heart of the approach. What did that mean in South Africa and back in the day?
Well, I always get suspicious when academics have a kind of one thing that they always argue for, because you think, well, they get in a point where they're going to argue for that, whatever the research comes out with. But cash plus care is what keeps coming up over and over again. And what the first time that we ever looked at it, it was because the head of children and HIV at UNICEF, a brilliant woman called Rachel Yates, cornered me in Addis Ababa at an African Union meeting and asked me if I could test whether social protection, whether government cash transfers, which are kind of like the British Child Support Grant. In fact, they're modelled on the British Child Support Grant, Child Benefit, to test whether those reduced HIV risk for children, for adolescent girls in South Africa. And it took us about 18 months to work out how to do it, but we were doing a study that was a longitudinal national survey. And at the same time as we did it, the South African government was rolling out a national child protection, a child support grant for under 18s. And we found that cash transfers to the household, it was about $20 a month, substantially reduced these HIV risks for adolescent girls. And then we found that when that was combined with supportive parenting, particularly good parental monitoring of teenagers, that we saw really strong reductions in HIV risk for adolescent girls and adolescent boys. And that was the first time that we thought of that combination, that the evidence came up with that combination of cash plus care. The phrase was actually made up by a colleague of mine from World Vision. And it was the night before a UNAIDS meeting, and we were sitting in this freezing cold youth hostel in Geneva, where UNICEF was putting us up there. And I think they'd, you know, the budget, everything's so expensive in Geneva. I think that this was the budget option. And we were sitting on these in this freezing cold. And he said, "Can you talk me through your presentation?" And I presented the whole thing, and he looked at it and he said, "Cash plus care." And I changed the presentation and presented it the next morning to UNAIDS, and they put it in their global AIDS report. And that was the beginning of everything.
And what sits behind that is the unspoken horror, I guess, that actually girls in particular, and to an extent boys, were being trafficked, being sold for sex for one way or another. They were more likely to be exposed to that threat if the family was short of money than if the family had sufficient money. Or am I wrong to say that? Is there more afoot than that?
You know, when we started doing this work, people knew, and the evidence showed that transactional sex and age-disparate sex was a major driver of HIV infection for teenage girls, which is the fastest rising HIV infection rates in the region. But really, it was thought that this was primarily kind of about bad choices. So a huge amount of money was going into education, you know, explaining to girls that these relationships were risky, teaching girls about negotiation strategies. And it really wasn't until we were looking at a large data set of adolescent girls in South Africa, and we were testing whether it was this risk, this transactional sex, was related to knowledge, and it wasn't related. We tested whether it was related to self-esteem. It wasn't related. It just wasn't, the data wasn't fitting the story that we were believing. And you know how you kind of like, you keep trying because you think that it must be right, but it just wasn't. And I worked with this amazing colleague called Mark Orkin, who used to be South Africa's national statistician. And he used to say, "The data does not lie." He said, "The great goddess data does not lie." And I remember we kind of gave up, and I went to bed. And I woke up at 4 in the morning, and I thought about the life of one of the girls that I'd worked with when I was a social worker. You know, what was her day like? She would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, like me, but she would get up to start heating water for her brothers and sisters' breakfast. And then she would walk for 2 hours to get to school. And when she got to school, she wouldn't have any money, so she would be hungry at school. And it just suddenly dawned on me that maybe we were looking at the wrong thing, and maybe we needed to look at poverty and what was going on in the family. And sometimes, you know, you put the right variables into a giant regression model and it just comes out. It's obvious that this transactional sex was being driven by poverty and violence and family sickness. And then from there, you know, to test whether a government child support grant can reduce that, and it did. You know, and sometimes the great goddess data doesn't lie.
Social science at work. This was the study of the Young Carer study, where you had to put 6,000 children and 2,500 caregivers. Is that the study?
That was that study, yeah.
I just want to take a moment to talk to you very briefly about the organisation behind the WE Society. The Academy of Social Sciences is a national body for academics, practitioners and learned societies in the social sciences. As the president of the Academy, I can tell you that we champion the vital role social sciences play in education, in government, in business. The list goes on. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us, or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. Tell us what we should be covering, who we should be speaking to, by emailing wesociety@acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. So now you're beginning to, and people are noticing and people are doing what you suggest, and it's scaling around the world. And then COVID breaks. And now, I mean, this is, you know, really something else. You've got 1.9 billion children globally in lockdown with their parents. And so you get involved in the COVID-19 emergency parenting response. And that's what UNICEF, World Health Organization, I mean, some combination of the UN agencies. And once again, you know, you are in a different context about kids being cooped up with parents, coming to conclusions that are first cousin to the ones that you established when you were back running the Young Carers study.
So I never really intended to do parenting work. It was a sort of accident that spiraled. But remember I said when we found that transactional sex was linked to violence in the home? Well, what we found was that families affected by AIDS had much higher levels of abuse and violence. And this wasn't because they were bad people or bad parents. It was because they were under huge stress. And I was working with the South African government at the time, and we were looking for what were the most effective interventions to reduce violence in a high-stressed home, or just generally violence against children. And my PhD supervisor was Professor Frances Gardner, who's the world expert on parenting programs. And I was, you know, sitting over coffee asking her this, and she handed me a systematic review and said, we should look at parenting programs. And at that point, there were evidence-based parenting programs, but they were commercialized. And so they were completely inaccessible to the developing world. And so we had a situation a bit like the one we'd been in HIV, where there was a solution, but you could only get the solution if you came from a rich country. And so we set about to make free versions, free to build an evidence base for non-commercialized parenting programs. And a whole set of colleagues, we kind of just got together from Reading University and University of Stellenbosch and University of Cape Town and Oxford. And we kind of divided up the age groups because we couldn't all do it at the same time, and ran, you know, over the next few years, 15 randomized trials of free parenting programs designed for the Global South. And so when COVID hit, we knew what was effective. We knew the core content that could prevent violence against children when a family is really stressed. And so the question wasn't so much what we needed to do. It was how we were going to get that from reaching 500,000 people to reaching hundreds of millions of people. And we had to do it within days or weeks, because with that kind of the stress leading to violence, if you can prevent it, it's much better than trying to deal with it once it's gotten really bad.
I'm sure that I'm not alone. I mean, I'd love to know some of the content of this. I mean, earlier on, you were saying, you know, it's all very obvious. It's about, you know, being affirmative to a child, problem solving where there are problems, even it may only take 5 minutes a day, I think you said. But I, you know, it's not easy being a parent, actually. I mean, and you are relying on your instincts and how your parents parented you, which is obviously, you know, most of our reference points. Sometimes that was good parenting and sometimes disastrous. I mean, what are the main takeaways of a good parenting handbook?
Well, first of all, these are skills that are going to become more and more available. There's been a real sea change that parenting programs are becoming open source. They're developing digital evidence-based versions. And I often think of driving. You know, driving is both an amazing thing to be able to do, but also, you know, a kind of dangerous thing to be able to do if you don't know how to do it. And I think, you know, we would never just give people a car and say, okay, you know, give it a go. Just use your instincts and what you remember from being driven around as a child and drive down Main Street. You know, we teach people some key core skills in how to drive. And parenting feels every bit as wonderful and risky as that. But there are just some key things that have such a strong evidence base behind them. And I think the first thing is about parents looking after their own mental health, their own needs. You know, we get so frazzled. And when you're exhausted and frazzled, you're more likely to snap at everyone, you know, your partner, your kids, the person who cycles close to you in the morning. And so some of the most key things in parenting are actually giving yourself moments to give yourself a break, taking a minute each morning to do a breathing exercise that just allows you a moment of peace.
Some of this, of course, it's, you know, the emergency response, parenting response, the exercise you did in South Africa, it's been addressed very much at the kind of less developed world. But large parts of Britain have incomes scarcely higher now than in middle income and upper income developing countries. And do you ever want to bring your kind of insights to bear on your home country?
You know who's done this amazingly? Professor Lorraine Scher at the University College London. She's originally South African and now British. And she somehow has the capacity to see how those two worlds link. And I think we're increasingly realizing that the transfer of knowledge and new skills and new solutions isn't just going from the global north to the global south. We're seeing things work in the opposite direction, particularly in technology. And so the answer is yes. You know, the parenting programs that we developed for the global south are being used in Wales. And during COVID, you know, Oxfordshire County Council sent me my own tip sheets.
you wrestle with this. I don't know what your next kind of big project is going to be. I mean, what would you, you know, is there an intervention that you would love to make but can't?
So the next project is in planning, and it's going to depend on whether we raise money to do it, but we have to believe we will. And it's really to try and look forward at the next 10 years. What are we going to be facing as Africa, but also as a global community? What will climate change do for children's lives? What will climate change compounded by new increasing epidemics, by increasing conflict? Where will children most be affected? How will they be affected? And then crucially, understanding that is only in order to work out what can we do that will be most effective in building resilience, in helping them survive these situations. I've spent the last year talking to colleagues in African governments, to the World Bank, to UNICEF, to WHO, to all of our partners in the last 10 years, and new partners, new humanitarian colleagues. And they all say, we know that we need to plan for children, but we don't have any evidence. We don't have any evidence for children in compound crises, in the new polycrisis era. And I feel a bit like I did back when I was 21 in South Africa in the AIDS pandemic, where people were saying, we know we need to do something, but we don't know what. We need the evidence. And that feels like it's just the obvious next thing we have to do.
So for an era of polycrises, you're going to try and arm governments, particularly in the less developed world, with some simple responses which don't cost much money because they can't. And sometimes when I'm listening to you talk, sometimes I think to myself, you know, I'm admiring your steadfastness and the way you engage with these issues. It's great. And other times I think to myself, it really was obvious what to do. And I'm just thinking to myself, I mean, I want to believe that social science made a big difference, and I'm hoping it has. But I'm thinking to myself, maybe it was plain as the hand in front of my face that what the response should be in these things. What's your kind of, just to conclude there on that note? Just what's your, I mean, to a skeptic, kind of how would you convince them that actually the data and the social science that you do is central to the kinds of recommendations that you make?
You know, I think when we get it right, what we do is we give ammunition to the good. So a government or a donor or an international agency that want to argue for violence prevention, for economic support for poor children. What we do is we give them the massive data, the hard evidence, the peer-reviewed publications and the PowerPoint slides that allow them to make those arguments based on rigorous evidence, not just on moral argument. And that's why our social science isn't impactful on its own. No one's going to read my papers. I'm sure no one reads my papers.
Well, I'm not so sure, but anyway.
But it only works when it's a partnership, you know, when we're allies. That's why we were able to reach 200 million people in COVID, because we had a set of allies in UN agencies and NGOs and governments who shared our goals and who were then able to leverage the evidence that we had to get WHO to sign off in 24 hours on a parenting resource and then deliver it to 40 million people through their COVID response. You can't do that without 15 randomized control trials worth of evidence. But you can't make that evidence reach millions of people without the policy partnership.
And that means having the capacity to build these relationships and convince people. And having spoken to you for the last 40 minutes, I'm pretty clear why that is. Lucy, it's what a great kind of both kind of worm's eye view and top-down view of parenting. I mean, you've taken us from the 21-year-old Lucy, who's a social worker in townships in South Africa, through becoming a social scientist and using data to support more effective interventions, first in AIDS and HIV, and actually getting to the bottom of transactional sex for adolescents and younger, driving this, a kind of horrifying conclusion in a way, one perhaps that people at the time didn't want to confront, but you did. And then when the COVID breaks, some of the world's best look to you to lead how can the world's parents in less developed countries best respond to the crisis. And again, you've helped tens of millions of kids be in a better place than it would otherwise have been. It's been a privilege talking to you, frankly. And cashless care, that'll be emblazoned kind of on my brain. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Lucy, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Will. Such a pleasure. And thank you.
The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences. Find out more about the Society by going to www.acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast so you're the first to know when a new episode comes out.